If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to the Bradley Wiggins Show by Eurosport, the home of cycling in association with Lacca Bicycle Insurance. I'm Graham Wilgos. Brad, another huge day of racing, and we have a special guest with us
for today's pod. We have a very special guest, and it's an absolute honour. Pippa York, thank you for taking the time out to join us.
Thank you for inviting me. So,
really appreciate it.
Journalist and commentator Pippa York, welcome to the Bradley Wiggins Show. With an awesome cycling career behind you, in which you won. I mean, I don't know if I should hand the floor to you to talk about your own palmares, but
I'm too modest to mention it. The thing is, I'm not especially proud about my cycling career. So the things I achieved, I suppose you'd say it's because I worked so hard I expected to achieve them. So when it happened, there was the slight happiness, but it wasn't, it was more a kind of relief thing, which was, I think we saw yesterday with Alex Dowsett, you know, the relief of you know, for that, the amount of work you've put in, and the kind of realization that you're part of a whole kind of system, and it secures not only my kind of immediate career, but everybody else's. And there's a kind of responsibility once you get to a high level in each team. Everybody celebrates, but it's more a kind of relief than a celebration.
I don't think we have to announce palmares more than anything. I think it doesn't define you. I think you're defined much more than that in recent days. And I mean, I don't think there's anyone involved in cycling that doesn't know your palmares, really. Considering where cycling is now, where British cycling is now, on that, how do you view it now? Because there are more British professional cyclists than ever. We've had more British success than ever. But as a teenager, for me, growing up watching your career, there was only really, by 93 when I was 13 and watching the Tour de France, there was only you in the Tour that year, Max Chandry, and after that, of course, Chris Boardman, but Sean Yates. We were very few and far between then as British cyclists. And to become a professional in Europe then, what you went through to get there was not only sacrifice, moving away from home, trying to gain a professional contract as a British rider, which they would always give the contract to a French person or whatever at that time. I don't think people quite realised just how hard it was to break into that. And to do that, you had to be something special athletically, which you were.
The thing is, you had to go. So nowadays, a British rider can be British based.
Yeah.
And there's British backed teams. Whereas before, if you wanted to be a pro rider, it meant you had to go to Europe to do it. So you needed some kind of contact in France. So I went to France to be a rider. And I think you can kind of sum up how you were treated and what level you had to achieve. It's in the same way that nowadays we see that, you know, we had that recent story about the black riders and how hard it is for them to kind of integrate into the pro system. They have to be better than a white guy. And for us, when we started at the end of the 70s and the 80s, just to be a domestic, you had to be better.
What year did you become professional?
So I turned professional in 1980. So instead of going to the Olympics in Moscow, I turned professional.
But you got fourth at the Worlds, didn't you?
But I'd been fourth at the Worlds before.
At the Amateur Worlds, wasn't it?
At the Amateur Worlds when I should have won. But
where was that?
So that was in Valkenburg.
Yeah.
You know, to reach that pro level, it meant I had to go to France and race and be. So I ended up, I was, over the kind of the whole season, I was the best amateur in France.
ACB?
At ACBB.
So, were there other British riders there then, or did they come?
So the only English-speaking rider was Phil Anderson. So only two of us survived the kind of.
And Piper, he was after that, was he?
No, I was there with Phil.
Before Piper.
So Piper came the next about 2 years later. So the way ACBB worked is, when you turn pro, you recommended somebody to take your place.
Yeah.
So Paul Sherwin was the first of the kind of ACBB, you know, kind of Anglophones.
And he was well respected, wasn't he?
So he recommended Graham Jones, who then turned professional. And then Graham Jones recommended me, and I turned professional. And I recommended Stephen Roach,
right,
and he turned professional. And Phil Anderson recommended Alan Piper, so he turned professional. And it went on like that, kind of through a various set of names. And most of us turned professional. So there was a whole kind of ACBB kind of team, but spread out.
And you lived in a flat, didn't you?
So we'd stay in a flat and, you know.
Who did you live with?
Oh, at first I was with a guy called John Parker who didn't make the kind of initial triage. And then I survived the first kind of sort out. So the first selection of the, so they'd take too many riders for the, how many were going to be left, and only the best survived. So you had to win races straight away at the Côte d'Azur.
Yeah.
So I survived that by winning races, and John Parker got sent back, and I got moved into the main apartment.
Sean Yates was living with John Herity when he was eventually there, and he said there was no toilet in the flat.
I know there was a toilet when we were there. It wasn't that bad.
And he had to wee off the balcony, and there was a big green patch down there.
Or maybe that was just a thing that they wanted. That maybe
if there was a toilet, Sean would have weed off the balcony anyway.
I didn't want to say that.
Pippa, when we were talking earlier, you mentioned that you took up cycling in the first place as a youngster in Glasgow as a means of getting out into the countryside. So it was a treat, you were saying, to get on the bus, for example. You'd go and see trees and sort of, you know, greenery.
Yeah, so I was born in central Glasgow, so I lived less than a mile from the city centre, and there was no trees in our street or any of the streets around where I lived. So when I was a young child, my mum used to take us on the bus to the park to see trees and play in the park.
You didn't live in luxury either, did you?
No,
I was not. The Gorbals, no. I mean, to explain what the Gorbals
so the Gorbals right was one of the kind of roughest areas of, it was said to be one of the roughest places in Glasgow, you know, where if there was going to be a murder, it'd be somebody from the Gorbals that did it. Or if there's going to be a bank robbery, it'd be somebody from the Gorbals. But when you're a child, you don't see that stuff. You know, so for us, it was just where we lived. And quite often we used to play in the coal yard opposite, you know, where we, our house. We didn't have an inside toilet, so there was a toilet on the land and that kind of stuff. I mean, so nowadays it'd be classed as poverty, but we weren't aware of being poor. So when I got into cycling, it was more of a way of going out into the countryside and seeing the countryside. And then I quite enjoyed the kind of speed thing of it. So when I did races, I enjoyed the speed aspect of it, and I still do. So the whole kind of competing with people, that kind of sparked an interest in me. And I like more competing against people and seeing how good I could be than I did the kind of history of the sport and that kind of stuff.
Mm. And sorry, on that, when was the first time you realised that you were capable of going on to what you achieved? Or did that come from someone else who go, this kid is not like we've not seen before?
Oh.
Because your motivation was just to get out and see. It wasn't a competitive one where you still want to be the best in the world.
Probably once I started, so I did a couple of races. I only did six races as a first year junior. And then the second year I was a junior, I discovered that I wanted to be competitive and I got better and better. So I wasn't the best junior in Scotland, but I was almost the best. And I realized that it was just, and I joined another club called Glasgow Wheelers, and Billy Boslem there, who'd been a pro, and he explained to me that, you know, that your career was in stages and it was just a matter of percentages each year, that, and you achieved that improvement, you know, by upping your training load. So every year they would advise me on, you know, what kind of training to do, what to expect when I went to races. And I tried to, so every year I would do that. And as each year went on, I improved a couple of percent each time. So when I moved up each category, I was getting better. I was in front. So
do you put your talent down to talent, raw talent, or your application and grafting? Because you were a grafter, weren't you?
So it's a mixture of both. So anybody who reaches professional level is champion of something. So I was national champion twice before I went to France.
Yeah.
And then in France, I was, you know, best amateur in the year. So I wasn't French champion, but I should have been world champion. Then I messed up by a fault that I made. So then I was good enough to be a pro rider. But at every level I reached, so I could have been Scottish national champion and then British national champion and then best amateur or best, you know, competitive at international level. And I could have stopped at any of those levels. My talent ran out. I had enough talent and then I had enough worth ethic and enough kind of health to cope with the workload. And I had the character to deal with the loneliness of it, that I could cope with the requirements to get to professional level. And then I could cope with the life that I was living as a professional. So I didn't have a family structure with me.
So that loneliness, did that stem from your childhood from a family aspect, or the other thoughts that we now know that you may have been battling that time, that you felt lonely in that area, that suited you as a professional cyclist, because you knew, you resonated with that feeling, that you knew what that was like?
So my parents brought us up to be independent, to not to rely on other people.
But that wasn't the loneliest, would you say? Did you feel lonely as a child from a family aspect, or was it because...
No, I think I only had to deal with the loneliness of it once I realised what independence was. So as a child, we were taught to be, you know, to be fairly independent, not to have to rely on our you know, brothers and sisters and your kind of family situation. If we were going to be better ourselves, we would be stepping outside of what we knew, and that's how we were all brought up. So each of my parents' children, my brother and my sister, you know, we all went different ways, and we didn't rely on each other for kind of any kind of backup. I coped well with loneliness.
Did you make yourself lonely and isolate yourself, or was that from this underlying thing that, you know, in terms of...
I was quite happy with my own company. It came from the way that we were brought up to be independent.
Yeah.
That I knew I had to, as a pro, I'd have to rely on myself because I didn't have a family unit to be part of.
Yeah.
So when I came back after the race, I'd be in the flat on my own, and I'd have to deal with that. And, you know, people talk about the psychological aspects of it. So I did a psychological kind of assessment of who I was and what my weaknesses and strengths were, and how I was going to deal with the weaknesses without affecting the strengths. So that's what I did. I analysed myself through this kind of assessment, and that gave me feedback. And then I could apply that to the life that I had to live.
And did you apply that subsequently in your time as national coach as well? Because your relationship with Brad goes back to sort of the late 90s or the mid to late 90s with you as national coach, and Brad, you coming up as a junior too. Is that something that you took and you were able to be either more sympathetic or empathetic with the riders that you had under your care?
I think I probably understood, you know, when you've been through that whole kind of, you know, these are the steps you're going to take. You want to be a pro biker? Okay, this is what you're going to have to do. And some of the young riders would say to you, oh, I'd like to be a pro rider. Well, liking something isn't good enough. You have to want it. Bradley would say, I want to be a pro rider. Whereas the other guys, oh, I'd like to be. And there's a big difference there in that mentality. When you like something, when you want something, it's totally different. You try to teach the ones that, the ones who'd like to be, you know, you're going to have to want it, because everybody else that you're going to come across wants it. And you're going to have to, you know, you're going to have to compete with them.
How did you distinguish from the ones you wanted and liked? Was that in an attitude or what? Just what they...
It's an attitude and it's a results thing. When it comes down to the really hard bits in the races, and you'd say to the guys, right, this is when you have to be in the front, and you're going to have to fight to be in that position, to put yourself in the position of maybe making the, you know, the split or the decision, the part of the race where it's the decision. And you'd see the guys and they'd fight, and then they'd tumble backwards and that would be it. Whereas the guys who want it, they would just keep fighting. And those were the ones who would be in the front, who'd make the decision. And they might, from then they might be flat out and they wouldn't have the talent, but they had the commitment. And then the ones who would go on to turn pro, they had both the talent and the commitment.
As a junior, Brad, but you must have been in awe of Pippa.
Yeah, well, I was in awe of cycling. But I think that soon went to one side in the dialogue that happened. And it wasn't just about being in awe where you couldn't talk to someone. It was more, I realise this now looking back, it was, you know, for someone who was probably, before we meet him, we talk about perceptions a lot. The perception of Robert back then was very like, awkward, difficult to get on, not really a people person. But it was quite the opposite with our group and the juniors, and particularly me, and this willingness to help and never referring to themselves in a condescending way. It was just, but I felt comfortable enough to be able to ask questions, you know, what should I do this? And there was no brutality with it. It was just very simplistic. And I found it very, I think when I look back, I think it was probably actually influential at that point in my career of wanting to transition from a track rider into, you know, I think I must have said to you that, like, I want to be a professional, I want to do this. And the information I got back was very precise, very simplistic. It was a huge impact on my career. It was probably the catalyst. But having someone there that had achieved what I thought, so it wasn't about awe, it was probably more of a respect, but I believed, because you'd done it and you made me feel like I could believe I could achieve that one day.
Thing is, being a pro bike rider isn't difficult. All you need is the talent, the commitment, the health, and the ability to cope with it mentally. That's all you need. And if you've got all of those things, you can become a pro bike rider. And it's that those are the four things you need. And after that, it's a series of steps which you take. And are you still coping with each of the aspects that you need? And you have a lot of characteristics which aren't given to everybody, or you develop them. So you take the kind of... you. So everybody has a certain amount of ego and a certain amount of selfishness, but you have to take that
to... You need that to succeed, though, right?
You have to have a whole lot of ambition as well, and not care what people say to you. Or you know, people used to say to me when I said I'm going to be a pro, and they say, "Oh, you can't do that." And I think, well, why can't I?
But you could see, so when we were talking earlier, again, you could see that the men's team at the time, you said, didn't necessarily have the talent to be able to support like Matt Chiandri, for example. But therefore you chose to encourage the juniors further because you could see that you thought they had the ability.
When I was national coach, and it was the British-based, you know, and it's not a slight on them that they've reached their plateau where they are in terms of performance.
Yeah.
But they've reached barely international level, so they're not going to be competitive. So they're going to get dragged around, and after 4 hours, if they're lucky, they're going to get spat out the back because they don't have the physical ability to last any longer. They might have the other three characteristics, but they don't have the ability. Whereas Max Chiandri has the ability to survive till the end and be part of the decision.
Yeah.
So then it's about a matter of discussing with him, how is he going to use those guys? And can he use them? Probably not. So how is he going to ride the race? Who is he going to base his race on? And when is he going to decide to start racing after the, you know, after 5 hours, the race starts for the pros and you're into the last hour and a half of racing, and that's when the decisions are made. But you have to survive those first 5 hours without hurting yourself,
yeah,
and being in the right places and know when to move up.
What are your early memories of Brad? Was it clear to you that he had the ability then?
So Brad had the talent, and then it's a matter of, can he cope with the workload? Does he have the ambition? And do you have the health? Because it's okay coping with the workload as long as it doesn't have a detrimental effect on your health. And then there's the ambition thing. Have you got the commitment? You know, can you cope with the amount of kind of selfish stuff that you have to do? And you see the people. So if you're in a relationship, you can see how that affects the people around about you. Whereas let's go out for a walk. Or now I'm going to have a lie down, that kind of stuff. And you need to find the right kind of people that are going to deal with that. But it also, as a person, you know, you see you're being selfish and it hurts you. As a person, you know you're being selfish and you know why you're doing it, but it doesn't always sit well with you because you know that it's not a kind of socially accepted thing to do.
Yeah.
And it's not what people expect of you. And that can be quite difficult. But also, when you're in the front in the race, you forget all that stuff, and you're in the front, and it's exciting, and you're living the moments that people remember. So then you're in that whole adrenaline-filled world, which is, you know, which you don't realize you live in until you stop.
Yeah, you gave me a training program that winter after the '97 Worlds, and I followed it to the T, and we did weight training, which you talked us through, which now most riders do, and it was the early days of, you know, introducing weight training into your program. But then I remember one day you rang me and said, you won't be hearing from me anymore because I've been fired.
Because I've been fired, yeah.
Which I think is, I remember being really disappointed and, but quite, you know, disrespectful, really. I mean, on what grounds do you get fired? But, you know, what was that like for you? But it's interesting, isn't it? Because that was the catalyst then for you going off and living your life and being the person you are today.
So the 5 years after I stopped kind of racing were probably the most difficult. So I'm dealing with, you know, the loss of the ups and downs, the excitement and the adrenaline hits that you get from racing. So my life didn't have the highs and the lows that I was used to. So every day became a kind of grey day. And then I was also having to deal with the feelings that, yeah, I'm going to have to transition. I think I'm going to have to transition. How am I going to deal with that?
So that was already on your mind then?
So that was on my mind probably from, you know...
As a racer?
Probably from about the age of 29 or 30.
You know,
I'm thinking, how am I going to deal with what I'm thinking, you know?
Did you have anyone to talk to about that then?
Oh, no, you can't talk to anybody about it. And nobody understands it because...
Did you question yourself?
Well,
you just knew.
I think you're dealing with a whole lot of guilt and shame. You know, you see people, and you know, nowadays they come out, and you know, it takes quite a long time for them to come out.
And was that informed by what's the cycling world going to make?
That's informed by how you know, so how transsexuals were dealt with then. You know, there's a mockery of you, and it's a scandal, and it's, you know, it becomes a subhuman
and
thing.
And that was manifested by you being Robert Miller, King of the Mountains and the Tour de France, and everything. That made it worse, did it?
So I'm presenting as this kind of. Not peak of masculinity because I'm small and I'm not very big, you know. But I'm achieving something in the macho world, which so I'm the first Briton to win a Tour de France classification, so it's a big thing, you know. So it's a big thing for Britain to, you know, have somebody who win a classification. Yeah. Even
and
nowadays,
finished fourth in the Tour de France. When I finished fourth in the Tour de France, my first words on the Champs Elysees were, "I've equaled the great Robert Miller's fourth in the Tour de France."
So when I raced, I looked at what came before me in terms of performance, and I thought, I want to beat that. So that's how ambitious I was. So Tom Simpson would be world champion. So I was never a world champion. So I was annoyed that I'd never been world champion.
You came pretty close on your first attempt there, right?
So I could be in the front of the worlds and I'd see people go away and win the world. So I've seen how it's done. I knew the level. I was never good enough to be world champion, but I could see it happening in front of me. So, and I looked at the, you know, various races, Dauphiné and all that, you know, am I going to be the first Brit to win this race, or am I going to be the first Brit to win Catalonia or something like that? And that's what the level I set myself. So if I didn't achieve that, I was disappointed. So when I, you know, so when you're the first person from a country to kind of achieve that, it's a big thing for them. So then more people get, you know, more people come along and they want to do it. So you'd have guys like Brad who'd come along and say, right, what's the level? What's come before me? Can I be better than that? When I was national coach, I thought I never felt talented. I always thought, oh, it's just a matter of hard work. And I'd see guys who were more talented than I was as a junior, and I think, well, they just need a bit of, you know, pushing in the right direction, you know, a bit more commitment, a bit more ambition, and you'll be a better rider than I was.
I read an interview with you, Pippa, with David Walsh in the Sunday Times, and I think you said to him that as a rider, you felt like you were only 5% happy. Whereas now you'd put that
person
the other way around.
Yeah, as a person, yeah, I would only be 5%. I'd only be happy at 5% of my kind of living time. You know, so in the race, you don't have time to think about a whole lot of stuff, you know, personal stuff, because you're absorbed in the race.
Yeah.
But when you stop and you come down after the kind of that first hour, and then you're back into being a normal human being time.
Yeah.
Then you've got time to think about who you are and what you're doing and the people around about you. And then I could realise I wasn't happy.
Yeah. I mean, it sort of builds to Brad's point of when you were fired. Is that fair to say you were fired from your job
fired,
as national coach?
Yeah, I wasn't.
I was trying to be delicate about it. I don't know why.
The thing is, that's how brutal it was.
Yeah.
On what grounds?
That I wasn't good enough to fit in what was coming next. I wasn't that insulted by being fired, by saying, okay, right, what you have to offer, it doesn't fit into what we're going to do. Okay, that's fair enough. But then I had to ask for my P45.
Yeah.
And I found that more insulting that I had to, because normally they should have sent that out to me. So then I go down to the unemployment or whatever it is and say, okay, I've stopped working. I have to hand this over to the tax people. I had to ask for that.
Yeah.
They did that on purpose, not to make me feel
to make you feel insulted. But did that give you that? Did that then give you to build on Brad's point? Did that give you a platform
that just reinforced that I didn't want to live in the male world anymore.
Yeah.
When you look back, do you see that as like the catalyst? Because we said, had you survived in that job for 10 years, you may never have transitioned.
No, I'd have transitioned, but I would have had to have given up. Whereas I got fired, and. You know, there isn't just one thing when you decide to transition. It's a whole heap of things. It's not as complicated. It's so complicated.
And it's a long process as well.
I had reached a really low point in my life.
Had you always planned to transition?
No.
No.
And no, I had to reach a really low point where I thought, shit, it has to be better than this. So then I had to transition.
Yeah, yeah.
So then I sought medical help. But, you know, I had to reach a really low point before I sought help because, you know, when you come from that kind of sporting where we are used to relying on yourself and you're not allowed to show any kind of weakness, there's a defense mechanism that you always have that people aren't allowed to see who you are. How
did that include your family at that time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you have that defense mechanism. You know, as a person, you have a certain amount of privacy that you cope with. You know, that you won't tell your partner or your friends, and you need that amount of privacy. But when you transition, you have to give up that when you go to counseling. And you go for psychotherapy, you have to kind of give up that and explain who you are.
Which goes against your ingrained loneliness and ability and to be able to do that.
And the whole kind of macho world you've
experienced. But it also aids your ability to be able to cope with that.
Yes.
But at some point, that ability to cope with it got to a point where you got to...
Yeah, I reached a point where I didn't cope anymore. I wasn't coping as a human being.
In the fact you didn't have anyone to speak to either.
No, so then I had to do something about it. And then it's a matter of, okay, at what level of transition am I going to be comfortable? You know, so the thinking at the time was, you know, so I started taking female hormones and that reduced my kind of testosterone levels drastically. It could have been that it wasn't for me. You know, the feelings that I got from taking female hormones might not have suited what my brain wanted. So I could have said, oh, no, that doesn't work. I'm not happy with that. I don't like the feelings. I don't like the kind of physical changes that it's made. And that could have been the end of it. And then I'd had to exist, I don't know, as a transvestite or a crossdresser or something, you know, looking for those kind of moments of emotional comfort. And at each level of kind of transition that you go through and you're kind of stepping up the hormone levels and the kind of physical changes, I could have stopped at any one of them. And being happy, and then just had to cope with that level of kind of transition.
Mm. I don't think people fully appreciate the external pressures from a media point, which we probably can't go into for legal reasons, but I don't think people appreciate, I spoke a lot about it the last few weeks, that adds on impacts on people's lives and how they...
Impacts your mental health, yeah. And
just not that, but people around you, you know, that there are repercussions for this, because this is far greater than just yourself, because there's family involved and things like that. So I don't think people fully appreciate it changes
the dynamic between. I tried to explain it as, you know, so if you went home to, I don't know if you're married or not, but if you went, say, I'll make the presumption that you're married. So you go home to your wife and your wife says to you, I'm not happy with being a woman, I'm going to transition to a man. And you think, well, I didn't sign up for that, but how am I going to be seen? And if you are, do you want to be in a gay relationship? Do you want to be seen in that kind of same-sex thing? You know, so it brings a question to everybody else's identity and sexuality. And I can see you thinking...
No, and you have children at school then, didn't you?
And then your children are affected because, you know, so...
Well, that's what I was coming to. So there's people around you who will be affected as well. And it's not... So, I mean, I would imagine... There was no way you could have transitioned, for example, at the height of your fame.
Well, no.
Partly because it was a different time. You know, the 80s were, you know, far more sort of
So the 80s, you had Section 28. You had Thatcher had banned the education of young people on kind of gay life or whatever you want to call it, you know, gay relationships. So you had Section 28, which was the banning of that education in schools. So being gay is one thing. Being transsexual is a totally, it moves on beyond that to being totally unacceptable at that time. So it was you were a moment of entertainment almost.
Your fame would have compounded it as well.
And your fame brings a whole lot of, and Bradley's seen this, is once the media starts picking on you and has something that they can exploit as a weakness or what they perceive to be a wrong. And quite often transsexual is seen as wrong.
But the way they tell the story is quite sensationalised and also factual.
It becomes sensational and it becomes a scandal and it becomes the whole says, oh, we shouldn't let this happen kind of thing. And as soon as you use should, it implies wrong. And the way it's presented and the way it's quite often written in the media, it can be, you know, that story can be told really poorly. And have an effect not only on the person who's directly the kind of object of mirth and scandal, but everybody in that little unit.
How independent you were, your upbringing and for that independence, your strength as a person. When you say you got to a low point, I mean, How low was that?
How low was that? I would be on antidepressants on a...
Did it ever potentially manifest into...
I never felt suicidal because, you know, you read quite a lot about trans suicides. I've never felt suicidal, but I can understand people that do. So because I'd done the kind of psychological training and how to cope with the parts that I didn't like about myself, I was able to cope with that kind of stuff. But I could understand why people would say, oh, I'm going to go and throw myself under that train that's coming. You know, I could understand that, but I knew the kind of the mechanisms to cope with that. But I, you know, I'd be on antidepressants, I'd be, I think, probably for most of my transition, for most of that 3 years. And then when the whole Daily Mail thing happened in 2007, I was back on antidepressants again after I'd weaned myself off of them. So I was back on, I think, another 2-3 years then, just because of the whole kind of circus that happened then.
Because, you know, on perceptions we talk about, when I was junior, your greatest perception in definition of you as a person was, you know, what's Robert like? It was, you don't give a f-. And it's funny that, you know, you actually did.
Oh, yeah, you do.
But I know, but your perception was that yourself, you didn't really give a f-. And it just shows you what someone like. You never really know someone.
And you know why that is, because you have that, you need a certain amount of privacy. So if you can stop people coming and asking you stupid questions and taking your time, it gives you time to think about who you are and what you do in your recovery and all the rest of it. So the less number, and David Walsh said to this to me, he said he wouldn't come and see me because he was scared of me.
Yeah.
and I'd say, well, that was deliberate, because if you came in and took half an hour of my recovery time, that's half an hour I didn't have.
So was there a line, I think it might even have been published in a French interview, but you said the only privacy you have is inside your own head.
Yes. When you're at the Tour de France, it is that. You, and you'll know this from you, and you'll know even more from being Yellow Jersey and the winner. The only time that you have to yourself when you're in the front of the race is when you're in your room on your own.
Yeah, and I used to room on my own because I was the ninth rider. I was
and quite home. Often, you know, you'd be at the Tour and they'd like to see you pictures of eating your dinner. And somebody would come in and say, can I take pictures of this? You know, you're eating your spaghetti or whatever, and you're hoping not to get it splashed on your jumper, and so you look like a fool. And they'd ask, and I'd say, no, you can't. And they'd be really pissed with me. And I'd say, well, this is my private time. Yeah. I don't come to your house and take pictures of you when you're having your meals with your family and your wife or whatever. And you've asked me if you can do it, and I've said no, because this is my privacy. And they'd go away really annoyed, saying I was difficult. But if they hadn't asked, I wouldn't have said anything. But as soon as they ask, can I do this? It's either yes or no. And I would say no. Every time I'd say no.
And how do you find it now? So how do you find, first of all, almost reintroducing yourself as Pippa York? And how do you find a sort of social reaction to you as well? Certainly from people who knew you before as Robert, and people who now know you as Pippa.
At first, it'd be quite difficult. You know, the whole kind of coming out thing is quite difficult. It's quite a very emotional thing. Yeah. So I found that quite difficult. But as it's went on, it's easier to deal with. So when I go back, you know, so after tonight, I'll go back and I'll analyse what's happened, how I felt about it, how I've answered the questions. So that kind of analytical aspect of my character has stayed the same. So I'm still looking at my performance as this podcast, or if I do any kind of commentating, I look at that and I analyse it and say, oh, that wasn't very good.
I find that absolutely fascinating.
And
Having not seen you for a long time, I don't see you as Robert. I take you as you now, and I see you as you now. Almost a better version of you, because this is the person you always wanted to be. But there's a pathway to the memories which you can never deny. You remember when we spoke about this? Remember we spoke about it? And the only thing I can correlate that to is, it's almost like you're talking to someone's widow of, they knew everything about their husband, you know? I see you as Pippa now. And that was instantaneous, by the way.
So for my partner, Linda, is there was that thing where, you know, you're dealing with the death of Robert, which is, you know, so they're dealing with the death of somebody, so they're dealing with that loss. So there's a grieving moment for them that they don't have anymore. So people who go through the transition and they have really close, you know, so their partner or you know, for parents, they're going to have to go through a grieving process of the loss of that person, if it's a child or partner. And that isn't something that I had thought about during my transition. I understood that, you know, they were going to be affected, they were going to be exposed as being vulnerable, and they might be they would be bullied, so, you know, in that kind of stuff, the stuff that happens at school amongst children. And you try to, you know, you try to cope with that, but you know it's going to happen. So you know that your children need a bit more support. But I think nowadays, when people see me for the first time after knowing me before, they're quite happy to see a happy person.
That's where it starts with you, because the awkwardness comes because you're more open and comfortable with yourself than ever.
Yeah.
And so the awkwardness only comes from another person when, you know, but you don't get that with you. The reason you don't see Robert, you take you as you, is because of who you are as a person now. And that's instantaneous, because you are who you are. And I think that's, you know, I think when someone is just comes out as gay or anything, there's an awkwardness about them because they're not sure how the other person, but you're more sure of yourself than ever. There was more awkwardness with you with Robert and unapproachableness.
Yeah, because Robert has something to hide. So when I did the thing with BBC Scotland with Rhona McLeod, and I was going to do an interview with them, a radio interview, and then it became a kind of a visual thing. And I said to her about halfway through it, I said, I want you to show the vulnerability that I have now, because I'm not happy with being vulnerable, but I accept it as part of who I am. So when you live as a woman, there's a vulnerability to your existence, you know, so there's that threat of violence, and, you know, you have to take care of yourself, you're judged on appearance and all that kind of stuff, and that develops a mental vulnerability that you become aware of, and it's not something you have as a male. You know, there's certain aspects of your kind of life that you're not judged on. And I wanted her to show that I wasn't that same person where, like you said, where bounced off me. Now I don't have to present that. So I don't have to be that kind of defensive person. And I can't be, because, you know, my story doesn't allow me to be. So then I have to kind of accept it and...
Because you'd be quite short with people, couldn't you? You could be very...
Yes.
And I recognised that in myself back then.
But that's one of those things, you know, when you stop your career, that you realise you're allowed to be vulnerable then, because you won't be classed as a weakness. When you're a pro, you know, athlete at anything, you can't show weakness, because the people you compete with will exploit it. So when somebody says something crappy to you in the middle of the bike race, you just have to look like, oh, I don't care.
Which is exactly what happens, isn't it?
Mm. You know, so people, you know, people say crap to you. So you see in football matches and rugby matches, you know, where you had Zidane punch that guy in the World Cup, you know, in the final, you know, he said something really bad to him, and, you know, it's probably on for 90, 95 minutes, you know, he's said to say the same thing and he's lost it.
Yeah. Is it Marco Materazzi?
You know, and I recognised that incident. I said, oh, he's been on his case ever, you know, probably years.
Yeah. The headbutt in the chest, wasn't it?
Saying the same thing, and it's got to the point where he's like, you know, like, F this. And he smacks someone, you know, and you get that, you would get that in bike races, you know, somebody would come and pick on you, and you'd hear them saying about, you know, you've come to take our women, or you're taking our money, or you know, you shouldn't be in our country, that kind of stuff. And if you didn't have that facade with that the shit bounced off of, it would just get to you, and you couldn't let it get to you. You know, you'd go back, and I learned to take the anger that produced and use that, you know, at the vital part of the bike race, and hopefully then, you know, that made a little bit of difference.
All right, we'll be back with more from the Bradley Wiggins Show right after this.
Lacquer's Collective Cover is made especially for cyclists, for life on and off your bike. Lacquer has flipped outdated traditional insurance on its head, with no more fixed upfront premiums. Instead, your monthly contributions are based on the collective's claims that month. Your max monthly price is capped, but the savings are all yours. Plus, 80% of your money goes straight back into the collective, fixing, replacing, and helping. And the other 20% keeps their wheels spinning. It's as simple as that. And when things go bad, Lacquer's got your back. Claims are handled by experts and usually agreed within a day, with no depreciation or excess. They've ditched annual contracts locking you in. With Lacquer, if you want to leave, you can, anytime. Head over to www.lacquer.co, where new customers can get £10 credit by signing up today with the discount code WIGGINS.
Pippa, and this is a fact that I didn't know about you until we were talking just before we started recording. Is that something that drove you to, for example, qualify as a black belt in Taekwondo?
The Taekwondo thing was different. I went out on a bike ride one time, and it was at Tour of Britain when I was looking after the Scottish team. And I went out on a bike ride around Ascot, and this car caught me up, and I gave them the V's. And they stopped, and they jumped out, and these three lads jumped out. Who are you giving the V's and all the rest of it? And they were posh kids. You know, they were posh kids from that. They were at one of the private schools, but they were posh kids, and they were all bigger than me, and I thought, this isn't good. So, and one of them had found this bottle at the side of the road, and I'll smack you over the head with this and that. And I thought, okay, fair enough. And I went on my way, and they went on their way. But it was a road rage incident, but, you know, if I hadn't backed off, they would have, you know, it could have got worse.
Sure.
And I thought, I don't know what to do in that situation. So then I thought, you know, and I was getting tired of cycling, and I thought, I need to learn something new. So then I thought, I'll do a martial art. And the only martial art that was on at the local sports centre where I was Taekwondo. So I went to Taekwondo, and I found I quite liked the discipline of it, because a martial art is, you know, it's an army thing. So it's not like cycling where I had to learn everything. So I learned, you know, what are the steps? You know, I want to move up the grades. This is what you have to do. And I liked that. I liked not having to think about what I had to do for training, because it was all laid out. And I wasn't very good at it. But the application of it, because you're a cyclist, you work on a fixed plane all the time. So your flexibility is rubbish, because you've been stuck in a fixed position for years. So my flexibility was rubbish, but my commitment to it was the same commitment I had to when I was a pro. And when you go to your black belt grading, it's judged not on the physicality of what you're doing, but on your commitment to it. So when you go to sparring and you're sparring with somebody better than you and they're going to hit you, are you okay with that? Are you committed enough to that you can take those hits and still stand up straight? And I was, because I'd learned how to do that from being a pro athlete. So, and I wanted to go to black belt. So my Taekwondo thing was interrupted by my transition. And so I got to just before black belt, before I transitioned. Then I went back to it after I'd finished my transition. And I found them totally accepting of it. So I was probably the first, I think I was the first person who transitioned. But they had no problem with it, none at all. So it wasn't like the world I was used to, that kind of macho world, because you would think that a martial art would be quite macho, but it's not. So there was just as many women there as men in the club when training. So I did my black belt as Philippa, and then I did my second degree black belt as Philippa as well. And the aspects of it, I really enjoyed, because I was kind of attracted to that kind of obsessive compulsive nature of it. Oh, this is what you have to do, and these are the steps that you have to take. So I was okay with that, and I could stand up in front of the class and take the training, and not be too intimidated, or not to show I was nervous, because that was part of the process to be a black belt. Or to go towards black belt grading, you know, you'd have to take the class now and again, and you'd have to do the training, and you'd have to instruct the others, the lower grades. So I learned to do that. So that kind of helped me in my transition. That, you know, I like nowadays I can stand up and I can talk about my transition, and I'm okay with it. So I got something out of doing a martial art, more than just the kind of physicality and the flexibility and being a black belt. So, you know, most people do it and they go, I'll be a black belt, and then they stop. And I almost did that, and I'm a black belt now, I can stop. And I thought, well, everybody stops, why don't I do second degree black belt? And, you know, and when you get to black belt, you realize that what you knew about Taekwondo before was nothing. It's almost like being a pro. When you turn pro and you think, oh, I'm a pro now, I know everything, and you realize that you're at the bottom of the pile again, the hierarchy, and some guy who's, you know, seventh degree black belt, who's in the 60s or 70s, does sparring with you and takes your head off, you know, and they're not, they don't move, So yeah. So normally sparring, you know, it's a bit like boxing where the really good boxer stands in the middle and thumps the other one. And the one who's weaker moves about. It's the same in Taekwondo when you do sparring. You spar for somebody better than you. Yeah. You're the one that's always moving. You're the one that's knackered. And they're the one that can take your head off when they feel like it. And you only realize that when you get to black belt. And then you go to the next level and you learn a lot more about the history of it and the reasons why you're doing certain things. So being doing Taekwondo came from being the road rage incident and out cycling.
Brad, we didn't quite get to, you wanted to ask one more question.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story, you know, heartbreaking in some senses, but then to see you today, it's, you know, to me, just as inspirational as you were when I was 17. Do you think there's any difference now, any change? Do you think things are better for someone that was in your position now within cycling for it to be better and easier to transition? Or do you think it's not much has changed? If someone's in your shoes now, within cycling, within...
I think it's the transition thing is still such a difficult moment personally. The understanding of the whole issue of, you know, the case of a trans woman going to be, you know, competing with women, that hasn't been totally resolved because there's not enough people, you know, to do the study. But it's certainly easier socially. It's
more acceptable,
It's acceptable now, whereas before it was tolerated. You know, and before tolerated, it was mocked. So it's went through those stages of mocked, tolerated, accepted. And people, you know, it's not a whim and it's not, you know, a phase you go through. It's just something you're having to deal with. It's what nature's given you to you know, it's your issue.
Yeah.
And I think that's one of the reasons I talk about it is so it's an educational thing that, okay, this is what I was feeling. This is how I dealt with it. And this is what's happened afterwards. And at no moment has it been... Has anybody need to be fearful or feel endangered or you know? So I didn't transition to dominate women or to change how women live. You know, I transitioned to live in their world and to fit into it. And that's the case for almost everybody who's transitions. You're not changing that world that you want to be part of because you actually do want to be part of that. You know, you've accepted. How you're going to live as a female, and you learn how to do that, and you learn how to cope with that, and how to fit in, and I think that's what you know. That's probably one of the big aspects of you know of education is that you're not changed, you're not attacking women, you're not trying to dominate them, you're trying to fit in with them.
Yeah. So aside from being you now and being free, comfortable with you, and being able to commentate and talk on sport that you did and have so much knowledge on. Do you still, is there an extra motivation or the back of your mind that, because not only by talking about it is because there's no shame, you're talking about it because you're free as a person, that you might just help someone as well. So is that a motivation or do you realise that it won't fail to affect someone by talking about it?
It's interesting because my daughter asked me the same thing. She's, you know, by speaking about the whole kind of trans issue stuff, do I feel a duty? No, I don't feel a duty, but I feel it's a good thing to do. So I don't have a duty to do it because you know I'm my own person, but it's a good thing to do. That if it helps, you know, it will help some people. It won't help everybody because everybody's transition is different.
But would it have helped you back then?
It would have helped me, yes.
Yeah.
So
and did you look at anyone in other parts of culture and think, you know?
You know, certain aspects, you know, certain women I look at and think, yeah, I kind of like, you know, how they live or how they talk about things. It's a bit like everything, you know, when you're a bike rider and you look at certain riders and you think, oh, I like the way they race and you try to do that kind of thing. It's the same when, you know, in my personal life, you know, that I take clues and aspects of other people and I try to apply them to myself. So, but for a young transitioner, I think it's a bit easier because there's more information. You have the internet, so now there's all that stuff's out there. And you know, if you want to learn what the various stages are, you can, and you can ask other people. You can reach almost anybody now on the internet. So the access to other people's experiences is easier. And when people ask me stuff, unless it's really really personal, then I'll give an answer, and I'll try to give that answer as simply as possible.
But it's for others to educate themselves as well, for all of us, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
Because that makes it easier. Not fear facing that adversity and bigotry that's associated with
it. And it's, I don't think, it's not just a kind of trans issue. Where, you know, you look at, you see people, so you had Philip Schofield coming out as gay, you know, he's in his 50s. And there's no real shame to that. You know, there hasn't been any kind of social kind of shame into
stigma,
that. You know, there's no social stigma to it. So, but he hasn't felt able to do that. And do you want that for your children and the people that come after that? You know, your children's children? No, you don't. So then you try to educate your children to be a bit more open. And it's okay to be who you are. So that's what I try to do. So I'll talk about cycling and I'll talk about trans stuff and the human rights aspects of it and why there isn't any fear and danger and anything.
One thing I would like us to touch on today is Gent-Wevelgem. Not specifically the result, but Mark Cavendish's interview afterwards.
Yeah.
So Cav... Turning up on Belgian television very, very shortly after he finished the race and breaking down in tears. Mm. So we've actually got that clip now.
Mark Cavendish, I can see it, and it was a really hard day for you. I see you're getting emotional. How was your day? That's perhaps the last race of my career. Do you really think this is your last race? Did you want to show something?
Brad, what do you make of this one? I mean, Cav saying it could well be his final race as a professional.
Mark's like my little brother. I love him. We get, you know, it's not nice watching him cry on the telly like that. I don't think it's for someone who's done so much in his sport, world champion, you know, San Remo winner, 30-odd stage in the Tour, to be a catalyst and one of the people that catapulted cycling to where it is in this country, you know, have to exit a sport that he loves and thrives on like this through other people's decision. He, you know, you always want to have an element of control when you leave the sport. But Pippa knows this too well, you know, she left the sport when her team folded the week before the Tour de France, having won the national title. And it's not a nice way to go. You always want to feel you're, you know, in control of when you decide how to stop, the fanfare that goes with it. So to see Cav go like that, if it is to be his last race, I must say, is not very nice, because part of me thinks he deserves a far more... I understand there are financial implications and teams and money and this and the other, but someone somewhere should stand up and go, this guy deserves a far better send-off than crying at the end of Gent-Wevelgem. And it's not with a victory, but just with the respect he deserves, because it's not till he's gone that we appreciate what this guy has done for British cycling and cycling as a whole.
Mm.
The greatest sprinter of all time.
Unquestionably.
And our second world champion since Tommy Simpson.
Yeah. Pippa, what do you make of this one?
It's like Brad said, you know, you come into pro ranks a small person and you don't want to leave a small person. And, you know, and if you develop, your career develops in a kind of, you know, that kind of bell curve, and you can see it coming, but you don't want to leave in a crappy way. You know, you want to leave with a bit of dignity. And if you can't, that's really hurtful.
Mm.
And, you know, for the greatest sprinter of all time, if you know, if Cav was Belgian or Dutch or French, you know, somebody would take him on in the team, you know, despite his lack of performances this year. You know, he would be a much bigger personality than he is in Britain.
We've actually got an interview with Rod Ellingworth as well. Ola Shenouy spoke to him earlier today.
And Rod, I know you're keeping an eye, a very close eye, on all races right now. Mark Cavendish was racing in Gent-Wevelgem today and said on Belgian television that that could have been his last race. What can you tell us about that?
Okay. Well, I mean, we're still talking. Obviously, you know, due to this situation this season, everything's happening later in the season as well, you know, so recruitment is happening later. We're still not complete for next year. You know, we've really recently only just really secured the finances going forward. So, you know, Mark, like many riders, are out of contract at the end of the year. So there's plenty of discussions going on. I mean, obviously Mark's, you know, getting to that age where maybe he's starting to think about post-cycling, you know, and you know, he's not had the most successful of seasons that he was perhaps after. So I haven't spoken to him about that in the last few days, but you know, let's see. I think the next few weeks will be quite critical for all riders who are out of contract.
So Rod actually said that they're still in discussions with Cav.
Yeah, and, Rod owns the team. Rod's the manager of the team. Rod needs to, yeah. Just, I wouldn't imagine it'd be about money or anything like that, but just sign the guy, you know? Give him, you know, it's all right being a manager and this, and I've got, you know, can't put personal relationships, but sometimes, you know, Cav has transcended the sport and he's Cav. That's why we call him Cav. You know, we were like Ant and Dec, me and him in the day, Cav and Wigo. And, you know, with the season we've had, it's very, very difficult. But, you know, he deserves... He would race till he's 45 if he could.
The thing is, he still comes with... there's still media exposure with him.
Of course there is, yeah.
Because even if he... And I remember him saying to this, even when he gets dropped, people talk about him getting dropped.
He's a household name.
Because he's Mark Cavendish. He's the, you know, he's the greatest sprinter there's ever been. You know, so... There's still, you know, publicity and media coverage of him, even if he's not winning races.
But he's
just,
also
just by being there. But I'm sure when you're on a team with him, he's influential in how that team functions.
He's personality on and off the bike, but like you, elevated the sport within the UK. There have been catalysts within British cycling. You know, Tommy Simpson, Pippa, you know, Chris Boardman, David Miller. You know,
you're missing yourself.
Well, then me and Cav, you know, in that era, that. Part and parcel of why people get on a bike and ride their bikes, and it's bigger than ever. And if that is to be his last race, then Wevelgem organisers, get him up on the podium and fate this guy. Don't let him walk away crying like that in an interview.
No.
And I think that's a shame. And I know we've had a difficult year and he can't do the 6 days because of, you know, social distance and stuff, but...
Yeah. You saw that from Mark Renshaw with the Tour of Britain.
Yeah.
You know, his light, it was when the last day of the Tour of Britain that he rode was his last day racing, and they had him up on the podium and there's a presentation and all the rest of it. And that was because he was Mark Cavendish's lead out guy. So he wasn't Mark Cavendish, but, you know, everybody knew who he was. And, you know, as soon as he's up there and he gets to give, you know, kind of leave with dignity. But I'd hate to see Cav leave with them, you know.
Give him another year. Say it's his last year. And everywhere he goes, it's like a, you know, fate him. Because. You don't leave people leave the sport like that.
No,
you know, all great sportsmen get to leave in their own way, don't they?
Yeah.
And he does. I don't like seeing him drift off like that. I'll pay his wages next year. I ain't got any money, but I'll pay his wages.
Well, we hope Cav gets what he deserves.
Well, I'm worried he won't, you see, because cycling is the way it is and it's full of and someone's got to step in. Brailsford, come on. Sign him for Ineos for another year. Come on. Yeah.
All right, well, that brings us to the end of this episode of The Bradley Wiggins Show by Eurosport. Thank you to our sponsor, Lacquer Bicycle Insurance. Brad, thanks as ever for your thoughts.
No, for once, this episode ain't about me. Thank you, Pippa.
Importantly, Pippa, thanks ever so much for joining us on The Bradley Wiggins Show.
An absolute pleasure and an honour. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, quite right. Pippa, if we want to follow you on social media, where can we find you?
Oh, I'm on Twitter.
Yep.
Philippa York.
At Philippa York. You can follow Brad at Sir Wiggo. Yeah. Plus, you can follow Eurosport on Twitter at Eurosport_UK. And you can find us on Instagram and Facebook. Thank you, too, to our producer, Pete Burton. And finally, from me, Graham Wilgos, it's goodbye. If you've enjoyed the show, please do subscribe, share your thoughts, and rate us wherever you get your podcasts. Brad, we'll be back with a bonus episode tomorrow.
We will.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.